This is How Sound, the backstory to, the hell with it, you know the deal. Transom, PRX, I'm Rob, blah, 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 audio storytelling. Let's just jump in. I have a new favorite piece of tape. It's short, but it's powerful and clever, and it's unusual. It's a transition device between scenes.
I'm really proud of that, too. I'm sorry.
Rebecca Nolan produced the story and that transition, and she should be proud. No need to be sorry. Here, let me play it. It will make more sense to you when you hear the whole piece, but for now, let's just listen to the transition. A man pulls a pear off of a tree, and when it snaps off, the listener is transported back in time.
It's a steep drop, but he's determined. He leans against the trunk of the pear tree and reaches way up into its branches, towards a single ripe pear.
Ah, there, that's a good one.
His fingers wrap around the fruit, and he pulls it from the tree.
The first of the Turkish troops have landed in Cyprus.
This is the takeover of the Greek administration by Greece.
See what I mean? Isn't that a great piece of production? The way that's assembled, it's almost like the man found a magic pear. And speaking of magic, that's how Rebecca feels about interviewing people. It's magical.
You know that. All radio people know that. It's this little window into people's lives and this kind of permission to ask them anything. And I don't know, I get all romantic about it, but I feel like it's the closest we get to connect with other people sometimes. And so I experienced this for the first time through folklore.
Rebecca is a trained folklorist.
Like quasi-folklorist, maybe.
Okay, fine. She's a quasi-folklorist, but she has an undergraduate degree from Memorial University in Newfoundland, up in Canada, and she defines folklore as the study of informal culture.
So it's going to be the stuff that you do with your friends or your neighbors or your family.
For example, bedtime rituals. That was the first subject she tackled in school. Rituals like reading a book or singing a song or telling a bedtime story while tucking in a kid, that kind of thing. She'd interview people about their nightly habits, transcribe the tape, write a paper, and then deposit the recordings in an archive. Later, she worked on a folkways project focused on ghost stories on Bell Island. It's a little scrap of land off the coast of Newfoundland known for iron mining.
I took the ferry over there and I went and I knocked on random people's doors to ask them about ghost stories. And they opened their door and there was this 19-year-old Rebecca being like, "So I hear there are a lot of ghosts on Belle Island. Tell me about that." And they're like, "We don't know you, but okay, come in. Here's some bread. Here's the story about the ghosts of the mines."
Afterward, tape in hand, she did the exact same thing she did for the first project. Transcribe, write a report, just info, no narrative, then deposit the recorded interviews in an archive. But after a while, that last part got to her, the part about burying the recordings in an archive. Rebecca says that seemed upside down because the voices of the people she interviewed, they're living and breathing and warm.
And then to take that and to kind of pull it out of its context and to kind of, sometimes it felt like dissecting and then putting it back on a paper, it just felt so far away from the actual thing.
And you wanted the actual thing.
Yeah. It felt like I was leaving them behind, you know? These voices and these stories, they don't live the same way as when, say, you're doing it with radio. I feel like with radio, you're maintaining that magic thing that they gave you, and then you're sharing it with people in the way that you experienced it.
That's when Rebecca thought, okay, let me try this radio thing. Now, to be clear, Rebecca says she wasn't dissatisfied with the field of folklore. She just really wanted to get the voices she was listening to out into the world, and radio was a way to do that. So she attended the Transom workshop where I teach, and she learned, to put it mildly, that radio and reporting is a whole lot different than folklore, in some surprising ways. Take the recordings, for instance. Rebecca says for her folklore interviews, she used a pocket recorder, a little something with built-in mics that she placed on a table to capture the interview. No broadcast quality recorder, no broadcast quality mic.
We don't tell them to turn off their music. We don't unplug refrigerators. We don't go to places without echoes.
Do they determine where the interview is going to take place?
100%. They do it wherever they want to do it. And it was usually kitchens, which, you know, is a radio no-no.
What were you taught is the proper way to conduct an interview for a folklore project?
Yeah. It's really, really hands-off. You go in, I remember when they were prepping us for our first interviews, they're like, okay, so yeah, you have your list of questions and it's more themes. So like, tell me about when you first learned how to bake, or tell me about some bedtime rituals, and you really open the door for the interviewee to just talk, and they're in control of the interview. You're not in control of the interview pretty much at all. It's best practice to let them talk until they run themselves dry of words.
So what kind of tape does that lead to?
A lot of boring tape. A lot of boring tape.
Even though Rebecca mostly works in radio now and finds quiet places for interviews and uses proper recording equipment and gets the mic in close and focuses her interviews to find stories and all the things, she still approaches some of her work like a folklorist. Take the story about the guy who pulled the pear off the tree, for instance. His name is Elias. He grew up in Cyprus, but now lives in The Battery. That's a neighborhood in St. John's, Newfoundland.
I spent hours with him not recording. I think it was just leftover muscle memory from folklore about building rapport, just chatting, talking to him about his life, about his kids, about other things from his past, about music. I really got to know him on this personal level where I feel like he's now a friend, which I know isn't necessarily a thing you're supposed to do with journalism. We're supposed to have this distance. But I've always found that distance very hard.
Do you think that that led to better tape?
Definitely. Definitely down the road, because some of the stuff was so personal. And then you get, I feel like as journalists, or not journalists, as radio people, we're trying to get those magic bits of tape. Like, that's our whole goal. We have a microphone and a person, and we want magic tape. And a big part of that is getting the person we're talking to in the mindset of delivering this magic tape. And I found that because I spent so much time with him, it was much easier for me to do that.
What else did you do in this interview that might surprise someone who doesn't have a folklore background?
Yeah. I let Elias listen to the piece before I sent it to the editor. I wanted him to get final approval of what was going to go out into the world for a lot of reasons. One is because this town is very tiny and he's well known. And he kind of laid his soul bare in a lot of that piece and a lot of the interviews. I wanted to make sure that he was comfortable with what the world was going to see about him and how his story was going to be told, because it is his story. It's not my story. And so he listened to it, and I was shaking. I was so scared about what he was going to say. I thought he was going to say he didn't like it, or say there's no way you can release this. I remember my knees were shaking. I had butterflies in my stomach. And he stopped the tape a couple times and said, "Oh, that's not how that went, actually. It did this, or instead of this, could you say this?" And I wrote those down and I changed those. But in the end, he gave me the go-ahead, which I know is not what you do in a lot of journalism. That call doesn't come down to that person. It's your call and your editor's call.
Right. I think of it this way, that it's their story they've given you permission to tell.
Yeah.
Whereas that permission part for you, you don't have full permission until you've let them hear the story.
Yeah.
What did he ask you to change?
I said in one of the drafts that when he moved to The Battery, people weren't welcoming. And he wanted me to change that because he was afraid it would hurt people's feelings in The Battery. He wanted me to let them know that some people were not welcoming to him in St. John's because he was an immigrant, but not in the community that he was living in. And then he also wanted me to include that he had delivered 10,000 babies. He said, "I want people to know I'm not just a man who grew a tree. I'm not just an immigrant. I am a doctor and I've done great things for Canada." And so I ended up putting that in the host intro because it didn't quite fit in the piece, but he was happy with where it went.
And so do you think it was still true?
Yes, I do think it was still true.
That's radio producer and quasi-folklorist Rebecca Nolan. Let's hear that magic moment she produced and the whole story. It's called The Pear.
A 75-year-old man lowers himself over the edge of a cliff.
And if I don't come up, look for me down among the trees.
He steadies himself using the long tufts of grass growing out of the rock, and they bend under his weight.
Okay, so far so good.
He's dangling over the edge of the battery. Below him, a single pear tree, its leaves and branches swaying in the breeze.
So, do you see any pears on the tree?
If you bend a certain way, you can see the city just across the harbor, the colored houses and the basilica. But that'll feel so far away. All that matters in this moment are the pears.
Yeah, do you see them? Yeah, on this branch. I'm trying to pull it towards me without falling down to the abyss.
It's a steep drop, but he's determined. He leans against the trunk of the pear tree and reaches way up into its branches, towards a single ripe pear.
Ah, there, that's a good one.
His fingers wrap around the fruit and he pulls it from the tree.
The first of the Turkish troops have landed in Cyprus.
This is the takeover of the Greek administration by Greece.
In 1974, when the war broke out in Cyprus, I had no contact with my family.
As the Turks advance, the number of Greek Cypriot refugees is growing rapidly.
I didn't know whether they were dead or alive.
Close your eyes. Imagine, just for a moment, that you are this man.
Elias Partellas.
You grew up in a small village.
There were about 700 inhabitants in the village then. I knew every house and every front yard.
You're the son of a farmer.
You know, we had melons and watermelons, and we had eggplants, and of course we had fig trees.
You sell figs and pears door to door with your brothers. You leave to go to school in a faraway country, and then you spend the next 3 years trying to piece together what happened to your family.
The family, the whole family fled, right? And some of them didn't even have shoes.
And to your home.
Asomatos. Asomatos. The name now doesn't exist. So when I look at the map, there is no name. I can see the names of other villages, but my village doesn't exist.
The Turks have drawn a new border across the island. Your old life, with your mother and father, is on the north of this line, on the other side of a chasm that no one is allowed to cross. You decide to leave, to wait out the storm, but you need to say goodbye.
And of course my parents were in the age that they didn't know whether they will live to see me again. Yeah, that was a very emotional moment.
So you go to this place between two worlds, to this new scar that shattered your home, and you look at your parents 100 meters away.
We just looked at each other with the space of the no man's land between us.
Somehow, your mother bribes one of the guards. Maybe it's the one with the large gun. And for a second, the war doesn't matter anymore, because you're in your parents' arms again.
I embrace them, and they embrace me, and we said goodbye.
You fly across the sea to another island called Newfoundland.
I came here on the 10th of October. It was a very windy day when I came. And I couldn't wait to get up in the morning and see St. John's with the skyscrapers.
But there are none. This isn't what you thought Canada would be.
So I thought, I won't stay in this village more than a few months. I'll go somewhere else.
But there's no place else to go. And so you move to a small fishing community called the Battery.
When I came here, some of the neighbors, they were not very welcoming because I was from CFA, come from away.
Because you look and talk different. Because you're not from here. Because you don't belong.
Yes.
But there's no place else to go.
Shortly after I came here, someone called me to go to the neighboring house. They found out that I was a doctor.
A knock in the middle of the night. A neighbor you've never met before is dead.
He was lying in the bed, and the bed was in the beautiful room overlooking the harbor.
Fingers to the neck, mirror to the mouth.
So it was a strange feeling, you know, to go in for the first time and see, instead of getting to know the neighbors, to go and pronounce him dead.
Maybe they pull a sheet over him when you're done. You hold them while they cry.
Since then, they call me the doctor. There are many other doctors since then living here, but I'm the doctor.
A few years later, you buy the house, the one with the beautiful view, the one where everything changed for you, because a man died and you were a doctor.
My parents, they stayed behind in the village for 40 years or more, hoping that they will save the village and they will save their houses.
Years go by, and your mother dies.
She was the last person to live in the village.
In the village that no longer exists.
When they died, they thought that, you know, the Turks will respect the fact that, you know, they own the house and they died in the house.
But they don't. So, in St. John's, you plant a pear tree.
Well, I wanted to plant fruit trees, but as you saw, it's very steep there.
Rocks above you, sea below you.
What I did, I knew where I wanted to plant the trees.
So you get a rope. You tie it to the trunk of the baby tree, and you lower it down the cliff, hoping that the rope will hold, that this new life won't tumble into the ocean.
It was hard, but nothing that I wouldn't do again.
Then you lower yourself down the cliff.
I used the rope again. I tied it on the fence, and then I was holding it as I was going down.
You can hear the waves. Here, along the edge of the world.
Most of it is rock there, but I found enough soil.
Something for them to sink their roots into.
In addition to the soil that was in the pot, made them just survive.
Back in Cyprus, time passes.
Again, things changed. Then we could get a special visa or permit to cross the border, and I did that.
You walk over that line your mother couldn't cross.
That was a year or two after my mother died.
You're now a father. You bring your wife and children to Cyprus to show them the house you were born in.
And the way to do that was to wait until Sunday, and on Sunday we are allowed to go to the village to attend a mass.
You pray. You want to go home.
But in order to walk there, which was only probably about 70 meters away from the church, we had to get the permission of the Turkish soldier.
He agrees, and so for the first time in 40 years, you walk down the street towards your childhood home. Your heart is racing.
What it looked like, it was run down. Yeah, it ran down. Before, we had fruit trees in front of the house, but the fruit trees were gone. But how it looked like the house, it looked like when I started walking and started talking. I could imagine myself in it, and I could imagine being there inside with my parents and with my younger brothers and sisters. I remember all the good times and the bad times that I had in the house.
There's a lock on the door, a sign that says, "Do not enter."
We wanted to just go inside the house, but the soldier said, "No, you're not allowed to.
You're inches away."
And then we wanted to take a picture of us, the whole family, in front of the house that I was born in.
He says no, but there's no place else to go.
We had to haggle with the soldier, but reluctantly he agreed.
You stand with your wife and children. You smile. And while you smile, you say goodbye.
So that's the picture I have in my mind now of the house in Asomatos.
Now, back in Newfoundland, in a room with a beautiful view, Elias Bartelis peels a pear.
Yeah, okay, so we'll see. Try to peel them. Normally I don't peel pears. I just eat them with the skin, but...
They're small. They could easily disappear in a closed fist. But they're precious.
I'm not sure if they are ripe. That's why we'll peel them.
And there's something loving about the way that he holds them.
So, do you want to try them?
I do.
Okay. So, the moment of truth. That's good.
What do you think it tastes like? I like to think it tastes like home.
It brings me back to the days where I was at the village in Cyprus. Actually, 2 days ago, just in the morning, I couldn't sleep at 4 o'clock in the morning. During the night, in my thoughts, I walked to all the neighborhoods in the village. Yeah, I remember each person, you know, what, who they were, what they were remembered for. You know, one of them was the fiddler. Another one was doing the roofs. Another one was, he had the bus. He was the driver for the bus. And it's very emotional even remembering that. Yeah, I don't want to be sentimental because these days what's happening with Turkey invading Syria, yeah, this reminds me of my family running away, trying to escape death. I don't have anything against the Turks. I know what's happening now in a lot of countries in the world, in Syria, in Iraq, in so many countries, and I see the photographs of the houses, how they're destroyed, the whole villages.
Once upon a time, a man planted a pear tree as a way to set down roots when his world was torn out from under him. The tree grew on the side of a cliff, clinging to the rocks for dear life, as the wind and this newfound soil pushed it away. But pear trees are tough, and it made a home for itself on that cliff, below a house with a beautiful view, alongside the North Atlantic, where thousands of miles across the sea lay a land full of fruit trees.
What is home? It's a place where I feel I belong. And the moment I come home, I feel I'm safe.
Rebecca Nolan is the producer of that story. She calls it The Pair. It first aired on Atlantic Voice on the CBC, and the story also earned a gold medal in feature reporting from the Atlantic Journalism Awards in Canada. So congratulations, Rebecca. Have you been listening to Nice White Parents? It's the podcast from Serial Productions and the New York Times. It's about the issues facing public schools and what the producers argue is the most powerful force shaping them, white parents. Hannah Jaffe-Walt hosts and produces the podcast, and she's so good at what she does, writing, reporting, tracking, the whole nine yards. And as I was listening, I wondered if she'd written anything for Transom, and lo and behold, she has. Back in 2011, Hannah wrote a manifesto called The Tricks of Planet Money. She was working for that program back then, and even though it's nearly a decade old, the essay is a great read. There are so many useful tips about signposting and foreshadowing and finding good characters and a ton more. It's at transom.org, The Tricks of Planet Money by Hannah Jaffe-Walt. How Sound is a co-production of PRX and Transom. Captain John Barth edits my scripts, and I'm fully supported, totally, by the Transom crew in Woods Hole, Jay Allison, Vicky Merrick, Sid Lewis, and Jennifer Jerry. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.
From PRX
and Transom.org.